Good morning, everyone. My name is Jay Stennett, and I'm an alcoholic. Amen. And God's doing for me today what I couldn't do for myself, because it's a little bit after 9 o'clock on a Friday morning, and I'm in Vegas, and I haven't had anything to drink yet. Pretty wild. I bring you greetings from the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, where this consciousness has been launched, but also from the 11th Step group in Manhattan Beach, California, of which I'm a member. The meeting's been going on since 1948, and it's a wonderful unfoldment of this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a couple of things before I get rolling. After I'm finished, because of the timing and the like, we're going to do a little Q&A. It is not part of the presentation, so you can feel free to throw things and run or do whatever it is that you like. But anyway, that's just a little thing. This definition, I'm going to be talking a lot today about mysticism. And this is from a book called Practical Mysticism by Evelyn Underhill. And it was written in 1914. This woman was the first female lecturer at Oxford. Think about that. Anyway, she says, mysticism is the art of union with reality, reality being all that there is. The mystic is a person who has attained that union in a lesser or greater degree, or who aims at and believes in such attainment. I call this talk Rocketed. Now, many people say to me, "Oh, Jay, I love the history." Until I talk about things that go against their ideas of what transpired. Now, this talk, which is the mystical journey of Dr. Bob and Bill W., is in their own words. And I stand before you one of the most privileged men. I was a history geek as a kid, and I still am. And what's happened is as time has gone by, I've gone through the process where I've actually been able and had the privilege to go to our general service office. How many people here have been to our general service office? Okay, now, go. Go. If you get to the East Coast, go to GSO. It's wonderful. And I've had the privilege of studying the archives there and reading a lot of Bill's personal letters, and also at Stepping Stones. How many has been to Stepping Stones? Yeah, okay. If you haven't been, go. And to Dr. Bob's in the archives there. Yeah, okay. Now, just so you know, a really wonderful thing happened just a couple weeks ago that's going to greatly benefit the women and men that come into Alcoholics Anonymous in future generations, is that both Stepping Stones and Dr. Bob's house have become national historical spots. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing for all of us. Anyway, the main thing about this talk is that this information is all coming from these guys. This is not commentary. I'm really good at commentary and telling you what it is that you should think about what it is that I know. But I can't tell you how humbling it has been to actually have the opportunity to read these communications. Now, there's a couple of things about this information. Number one, it is, for the most part, it is not publicly available. It's available to researchers and people that are doing serious study, that are writing books and the like. It's not just there for you to be able to rifle through. You have to go through an application process and the like. These letters are private letters. This information is how these people were living and what they were thinking. This is not the public face of Alcoholics Anonymous. So remember that there is a difference, like when you're out on the street or you're at the meeting, right, and what it is that you're telling your wife when you're laying in bed about this. So 85% of what I'm going to share with you today is from these people's personal letters. Now, I'll talk a lot more about Bill than Bob. Why is that? Well, Bob was only with us for 15 years. He lived in Akron, Ohio, not exactly a hub of communication. And he was a Stoic, and we'll talk a little bit about that. He was not somebody that communicated well with any living being. And then we have Bill, who was with us for over 30 years. And he was the point of contact of the evolution of a worldwide society. So that's why there's so much stuff. And he had things like secretaries and the like that actually helped him with his correspondence. So that's why we'll talk a lot more about Bill than Bob. But we've got some fun stuff about them. Now, before we get rolling, why am I doing this? Well, what I want to do is I want to introduce you to the varieties of spiritual experiences of Bill W. and Dr. Bob. And they were fearless, and they were open-minded. And you can talk to my friend Bill or Dennis or Pete or any of these guys over there, or even and the gals over at the table there, Marco, and they all have seen me very close-minded, knowing stuff. And so what I'd like to do right now, since every AA group is a spiritual entity, as it says in our traditions, could you just close your eyes for a moment and take a really deep breath and let it all go. And think about that first meeting that you walked into. And who was there? And what was on the walls? And how you were greeted? Thank you. Most of what it is that I'll be talking about is referenced in conference-approved literature. And it's always interesting to me. How many people have actually read Pass It On? Oh, I love this group. It's fabulous. Pass It On and Dr. Bob and the good old timers are just fabulous. And so if you get a chance, you know, people come up to me and say, what should I read in order to know the history? Read the conference-approved stuff first, because it's great. It's just great. So what makes AA different? Why is it that we have not evolved into a religious sect or a cult? And in the postmodern era, almost anything that is spiritual in nature gets branded religious. And the reason that I believe that we are neither is because of the example of our co-founders, who had a real allergy to hierarchy. And they were open-minded. They actually had the experience of the miraculous occurring. Their alcoholism was removed. I mean, here in the postmodern era, all of us, anybody we work with generally, has come into being with there being a solution to alcoholism and drug addiction. But when these men were around, there was not. There was occasional religious conversion, but that was it. And so they continued to seek. They didn't just stop. Now, this is William James. And he wrote a very important book. It's actually a series of lectures called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And it's a lot of fun. People say, oh, it's a very tough read. Well, it is if you try and sit down and read it like a book. I suggest that what you do is do it along the lines that I believe that Bill did, which is go to conversion. It's lecture 9. And there are all these different experiences, a couple of which have to do with alcoholics. And in this, William James said that while the revelations of the mystic hold true for the mystic, they only are true for the mystic. In other words, it's for the person that has the experience. The wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we are each charged to our own experience. We can be shown, but it's about our experience. We can give people the menu, but we don't tell them you have to have the steak and it has to be cooked this fashion. James also said that in this experience, they can hold no claim to truth without the personal experience. In other words, that when we sit around talking about this stuff, that we are coming from our hearts, the language of the heart that Bill was talking about, and the reference from the letter that the barrister referred to is in Language of the Heart, which is a hardbound book, but I guess you're right that it's not conference approved. I'm not sure about it. Anyway, but this weekend, what we're going to do is we're going to hear some of the most fabulously engaged and involved presenters talk about their own personal experience so that we may consider that experience and then try and apply it so that we will have our own. But I can't have Mildred's experience as much as I've wanted it at times. So there's a marvelous resource. His name's Mel B. He's written a number of books, one which is called My Search for Bill W. He lives in Toledo, Ohio, and he sings rather flatly. And he's a dear friend, and it was so wild to actually call him up and say, can I use your letter? And he said, yeah, go ahead. So in it, he wrote this letter to Bill in 56, and then Bill responded, and he said to Mel, he said, little by little, I think we shall strip away the mystery from mysticism. Indeed, the mystic experience, so-called, is the essence of an AA's transformation, whether he knows it or not. And again, by this, I'm not talking about woo-woo. I'm talking personal and you, and it doesn't have to be defined. But it's your experience of all. One of the difficulties the co-founders had, Bill said, because of a tendency to exaggerate me as a person and so invite a rather unhealthy dependence at the very time when it is highly necessary that AA's dependence should be upon God and certainly not upon me. I mean, he would just go absolutely ape if he hears the number of times that we'll say, Bill, Bob, because these guys, I mean, he knew intuitively that he needed to shed this mantle of being the co-founder. He hated the term. In fact, one letter I read, he said to the guy that he'd make him a co-founder for 15 cents. That's how much the term meant to him. So what else is it about this that we are not a cult, that we are not a religion? And Bill talked a lot about that. I do not think it imperative that either my theological views nor those of Dr. Bob ever have any appreciable influence on AA. That would only create another religion. And of those, we certainly have enough already. Now, we already referred a little bit to this correspondence between Bill W. and Carl Jung. For me, it is one of the great pieces of literature that we have. And you can Google it or whatever, but it's in Language of the Heart, and the grapevine will be really happy when you buy the book. When Jung was talking about Roland H., the man who took the time and passed the message of the Oxford on to Ebby, who then passed it on to Bill. He was talking about that alcoholism is at a low level a search for God. But recovery from alcoholism, he said there were three different ways that one could have it. The first was by an act of grace. Boom, you get hit, like what happened with Bill. The second is through a personal and honest contact with friends. And he considered Roland joining the Oxford group was that. And I believe that that is what this weekend is about. Is it's about some personal and honest contact with friends about how is it that we can deepen our experience and how is it that we can be more effective in transmitting it to others. And then he says, or a higher education of the mind beyond the confines of mere rationalism. Bill Cleveland will tell you that he's had to put up with a lot of non-rationalism in being involved with me. So, the spiritual journey begins. What better place for a journey to begin than in a hospital for drug addicts, alcoholic, and neurosthetics? And I love the fact that that we're meeting at this time of year at the celebration of Bill's personal awakening. In a letter that, and look at that, there's drug addicts and alcoholics there, together in the same ad. Shocking. Stop them now. In talking about my flash of reality, capital R, of my flash of experiencing everything, I often feel it's necessary to make a point that every AA that gets the program gets the same thing. There is no difference. He goes on to say that if you were to take the sum of your own transformations and collapse that whole business into 6 minutes, you'd see stars too. And that's a really fun thing to do. Maybe sometime this weekend, is just take a few minutes by yourself and think of all the wonderful transformations that you've received since you've had this terrible burden lifted from you. It says, one further point with me. The original experience was so large, the preview of destiny so intense that I've never had any difficulty with doubt since that time, even at my worst, which has been damn bad at some times. Bill had a classical spiritual revelation. It's in all the books, you know, and yet he knew that the fruit of that experience was what was important, which is that he didn't drink anymore. And that anybody that has the educational variety, you know, just sitting around in the meetings and kind of getting it, that there's no difference, because what's the fruit? It's the same. And how do we know that the fruit is ripe? Because it's able to be passed on to others. The other thing about this revelation, about this seeing one person talking to another, which again and again he references, is that I believe that he saw the fellowship almost whole. Because he needed something. What he and Lois experienced the first 3 years of his sobriety was incomprehensible. You know, the homelessness, the hunger, the poverty, anything that a guy puts himself as a guy about was taken from him. And yet he was able somehow to stay with it. And I believe that this was the thing that the experience allowed him to stay the course for us. The thing that I find really, really wonderful, and I hope that I'm able to communicate to you at some level today, is the depth of compassion that this man had and his selflessness. And the sacrifice that he made for others. And he was absolutely fearless when helping drunks. Because They didn't know what worked and what didn't. And so therefore, they were able to try things that maybe we won't try today.
Because it's not what was shown me.
But again, what comes to your heart? And I believe that the best way to describe Bill's life comes from this letter. He says, I often wish the never-say-die skeptics, in other words, the guys who say, show it to me. If you can't show it to me, it doesn't exist. Such as I once was, could have their own personal experience. For as the believers can be foolishly credulous and absurdly unreasonable, so can the skeptics. All of our problems are in the third dimension. The solution to our alcoholism comes from the fourth dimension, and the solution for all of our problems is of that nature. And Bill spent his entire life, I like to say, trying to tell people that we're stuck in the third dimension, psst, there's more. Come on. Try this. Try that. Anything that he could do, when someone would come to him and say, hey, we got this going on, he'd go, great, and he'd try it. Why? Because he wanted to be more helpful. Bill was describing Bob to some friends. He said Bob was made of better stuff, and his personal life always came much closer to spiritual achievement than I ever did. He seemed never to be victimized by awful conflicts. Though this is not for sure, because he was a real stoic. He didn't talk about, this guy, Dr. Bob, rigid, righteous Bob, 17 years to ask his wife to marry him. Great communicator, huh? Those of you who were privileged to hear Smitty, his son, talk, and I'm sure we got some great CDs out there with Bob's son Smitty talking, and he's a doctor's son, right? It's time for the birds and bees talk. The old man takes him upstairs. He goes, I am going to learn some stuff that's going to get me down with the girls. It's going to be great. His father, the physician, looks at him and says, flies attract disease. Keep yours closed. And walks out of the room. So this is what we're dealing with here, okay? So just, I want you to, so this is a man who internalizes almost everything. Bill also says, unlike me, he was a vast reader of spiritual and psychic literature. He had a great library of it. By contrast, and this is Bill talking about himself, my own reading has been very sparse. I still have rather relied on observation and conversation. Thank God. Thank God. It's really fun. If you've been working with people for a while, when somebody has a conversion experience, they'll come running to you and they'll go, oh my gosh, I've been reading the Holy Quran and it is absolutely, it's evident that Bill had a relationship with the Prophet Muhammad. Absolutely. Or the other day I was giving a talk and a woman came up and she said, how much time did Bill and Joseph Campbell spend together? I said, they had coffee twice a week. But we're always trying to put our, whatever it is that our experience is, on these guys. One of the things that's very interesting is, one of these places that I've been was, there's this fabulous book, The Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And people are always trying to, make this link between the two. I've been privileged to read over 500 letters and transcribe over 200. Never once is Dr. Fox mentioned. Never once. There's really only five or six books that Bill ever talks about. But I'll mention some of those later. But again, Bill's relying for his spiritual information on observation and conversation, which is this wonderful thing that we have the opportunity to enjoy today. Or this weekend, excuse me. So one time somebody comes up to me and says, did Dr. Bob ever do a fifth step? Well, there's nothing in the literature that particularly says that he did. But I was fortunate enough to run across a talk that Bill gave, and he talks about Bob and back to Bob's stoicism. He says, this is Bob describing himself. So Bob's come back from Atlantic City. He's withdrawing. Bill's tapering him on and off, trying to get him so that his hand doesn't shake to the point where he can do an operation. Bob was a proctologist. These were delicate operations. And anyway, Bob looks at Bill and he says, no, I'm really going to go through with this kind of thing we've been talking about. I hit bottom all right, but that's only a starter. I'm a guy that would never make a full revelation about myself to any human being. I'm one of those damned Yankees who just bottle things up and hang on and can't let go. So I'm going to get a house cleaning and you're going to listen. Bill says, you can't shock me. Fire away. And Bob goes on to say, I'm a guy who felt the stigma of this thing in this town, Akron. And though everybody in town knew that I was a souse by use of sedatives, I got through business by day. Nice. Nothing better than a tranked up doctor, right? And drank by night, and every once in a while, a little trip to the sanatorium. I'm a tough old bird who's just been going on for years, never willing to face up to the people I've hurt. And I think that's where the catch is in my picture. That's why I got drunk at Atlantic City. So one of the things that's fascinating to me, and this is the night before Bob goes to do the operation, is about the founding of this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this weekend, we are meeting at a point that easily could be construed as the founding date of Alcoholics Anonymous, the day that Bill had his experience. That would work real well if we were found in a cult or a religion. Or we could make it the day that Ebby came and talked to Bill. Or is it the day that Roland talked to Ebby? Or is it the day that Bill and Bob first met at the coach house? No, it's not. The day that we celebrate as the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous is this day. Bob does his inventory, and they're on the way to the hospital. And here's how Bob's sponsor treated him. We decided that we'd tapered the guy down a little bit too far, and we'd have to taper him up a bit so he could do the operation. So I brought a bottle of beer and I dropped a goofball into it so that his hand would be steady enough. He didn't tell Bob about the goofball. And for those of you who have always wondered what a goofball is, it's a barbiturate. For those of you who've been on the planet a little while, we called them reds. Second all, two and all, everything and all. But anyway, medical term. So he goes into the hospital. He does the operation. Bill and Ann are at home, and Bob doesn't come back. He doesn't call him. 11 o'clock at night, He still isn't home. Bill's packing. It's obvious he's gotten loaded. I'm going home. And he comes in and, where were you? I can just see Ann and Bill kind of flying across the room. And with that pre-Al-Anon look. And Bob looks at him and he says, I've been out mending fences. Again, the stoic. He didn't say, well, I was over here and I was over there and blah. No, I was out mending fences. Bob was out making amends. So the founding day that we call the start of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bob's all, you know, I mean, what would you say to somebody who'd had a couple of goofballs and some ale? Do your amends count? Does that fifth step work? The man never drank again. The man never drank again. So the founding is on the works, I like to say. So this next is, we're going to talk a little bit about psychic explorations. And again, a lot of this stuff is referenced in conference-approved literature. And this is about Bill and Bob's personal experience in their own words, not for them to be putting out so that people would talk to them about it or agree with it or any of that stuff, okay? So this isn't about what it is that you think about what they did. This is their description or the descriptions of what it is that they actually did. Smitty, Bob's son, says that Dr. Bob was even interested in people who claimed to have ESP and other forms of spiritual insight. He felt that in a few distant centuries, the science of mind would be so developed as to make possible contact between the living and the dead. This is Clarence. Clarence's story is in the book Personal Experiences, where it's got all the books that have been in the big books all the way from. It's the home brewmeister. He had a little resentment at Bill and Bob because he wasn't considered a founder. Very important person in our history. He's talking about this guy, Roland J. Roland J. had studied many faiths in his search for sobriety, but never did stop drinking until he met Dr. Bob. We would go to Roland's on Sunday night. He would call in the spirits. It got spooky after a while, beyond what we should be monkeying with. Doc backed off, too. Now, it's really interesting. Roland had amazing gifts. This comes from a letter by a woman, Virginia M. She said, Roland had been instrumental in healing some children, and her daughter was gravely ill, and they were going to take her up to Cleveland for an operation. And Bob said he thought spiritual healing would be worth trying, and if it didn't work, she could still go and have the operation. I hadn't met Roland, this is Virginia speaking, and when I met him, he asked me if I had any opinions upon spiritual healing. I told him I really didn't, one way or the other. He said, great, why don't you go to a movie so we won't have any interference? And she goes off to the movie, and when she came back, her daughter was running and jumping and skipping and having a good time after Roland and Dr. Bob had been working on her daughter. This is Bob's daughter, Sue, who probably has a better insight as to why Doc backed off publicly. She says, the Akron AAs were all against the spiritualist thing. Dad got the feeling that he was being criticized, and he was. They didn't approve, but I think what really got them was that they weren't invited. They're having secret meetings, and I didn't get to go. What's going on there? So this is Stepping Stones. Regarding the spiritualist thing, Bill says, I know to many that this subject is suspect or taboo or just ridiculous. Like most scoffers at prayer, they are practically always people who have never tried. The doubters in the field of psychics are mainly those who've never really investigated, let alone having any real experience themselves. This is the sort of thing which today is held in contempt by both theologians and scientists, lest their several systems of thinking be disturbed. So it's very interesting, whether it was with niacin, whether it was with spirituality, whether it was this or that, Bill was always getting a lot of heat. So what they did was, is they moved out to Bedford Hill, and in the culture, now again, this is the time that these, Houdini's rolling. I mean, there's a lot of this spiritualist stuff going on. And so they started to have a weekly meeting. And at this weekly meeting, there were about 15 people altogether that came. But I just wanted to show you that it was a well-balanced group. These are the co-founders of Al-Anon that are involved, by the way. Bill's talking about this stuff, and he said that he had this experience, right? He's had the white light experience, and he's going, and they're doing these seances and this and that, and they got the Ouija board out, and he's not getting any contact. Everybody else is. For 2.5 years, they're doing this, and Bill's not having any contact. And then, all of a sudden, he gets hit. He gets this incredible wealth of information starting to go. And it's just flowing through him, and he's starting to channel different people. And Ann B. is writing it down. And I actually had the privilege of reading these notes from these meetings. It's fascinating stuff. And he said, I was able to bring in material from the other side that could not be explained. Could not be explained. And again, we're beyond the confines of mere rationalism. Okay? If you want mere rationalism, there's all kinds of places. There's that table there and this table here, and you're safe. But this is just describing these people and their own evolution. And so they're using this Ouija board, and they're getting all kinds of information. Bill sends one to Bob. Hope you got the magic tray, Smitty. And that's actually a letter. And he says, he talks about that what's coming to them is information that they couldn't have gotten just any other way. Fun story. Bill and Lois are visiting a friend out in Nantucket. And Bill's up in the morning, making coffee, smoking cigarettes, having a good time. Nobody's up. It's quiet. And all of a sudden, he says, there's this intrusion. It was a Norwegian. And he says, would you help me get a whaling ship? I need to get out of here. And Bill says, that's going to be a little difficult. He says, well, can you help me get a drink? There's nobody that'll drink around here with me. And Bill says, well, there's a little problem here. He said, you're dead. You're a disincarnate. The guy didn't know that. He said, Bill told him, now, if you just relax and start looking around and not getting upset when people ignore you, they'll pay attention to you and things will start to go well for you. The guy says, really? And he leaves. So Bill has another cup of coffee. He's kind of enjoying this. And another guy shows up, a shopkeeper, from 100 years earlier, who introduces himself as David Morrow. He says, great work, Bill. Love what you did with this guy. Would you like to meet anybody else? Just smoking cigarettes, having a coffee. Sure, bring them on. And so he actually brings a couple more disincarnates, not of the flesh, in, and they start talking. And these guys, he meets this guy that was killed at the... David Morrow, who was killed serving under Admiral Farragut at the Battle of Morrow Bay. There's Pettingill, who's a master whaler, and Quigley, who's another guy who was a captain of ships, and they're hanging around talking for a while, and then they leave. Bill's host and the rest of the gang get up. Bill never talked about this stuff with people that weren't generally involved, but this was such a remarkable experience, he starts talking to them about it. Everybody gets nervous.
everybody.
Get me out of here. What are you talking about?
Isn't it time for you to leave, Bill? Take your wife with you, please. But they had a picnic scheduled, and so they, you know, Bill drops the conversation, but he told the stories. And he goes down, and they go down to this war memorial, and there's a war memorial. And they look around, and son of a gun, if there isn't a plaque with the people that died at the Battle of Morro Bay, and who's on there? But this guy. Now Bill goes, do you think I made that up? Everybody's looking at him going, come on, you know, maybe you got it from telepathy or something. So later they go over to the Whaling Museum. And in the Whaling Museum, there's a log. One of the things you could do is you could actually look through and see who was it that's been here. And, you know, because they'd signed their boats and when they came in. Son of a gun, if both the names Pettingill and Quigley are there. And like Bill said, I wouldn't even make this stuff if I could. It's not that interesting to me. But these are the experiences that he had, and what they did was they informed his own spiritual growth. They informed Bob's own spiritual growth so that they weren't just thinking, it's got to be here. It's a lot more than what it is that we can see. Bob sends Bill a letter referring to this book, Thy Kingdom Come. He says, and you haven't sent me the letter like you were supposed to. He says, I want to come down and see the antics of some of your psychic friends. My bump of curiosity is stimulated at the moment. He says, now don't wait another 6 months to tell me your impression of this subject, for I am very interested in it. He says, maybe I'm slightly moist on this subject, being this spiritual stuff that's going on at Roland's house that's happening. But this wasn't just happening with these guys. All over the world, people were doing this stuff. Well, why aren't we finding out about this now? Well, spirit needs dark. Spirit needs quiet. Spirit needs peace. Find that. Just an opinion. But anyway, so he sends Bill this book, Thy Kingdom Come. Now, when I look at that, I see, well, this is obviously a Christian tome. But being a researcher, I've got to go and do a little stuff. And I start searching, and I find an Oxford Group book by that name. So obviously that's it. But I go just a little bit further, and I find out that Thy Kingdom Come is a book by a guy by the name of Ivan Cook that's the channeling of Arthur Conan Doyle. After Doyle had died and came back to correct some of his spiritualist friends on some of the things that they were just a little bit off on. So Bill gets the book and he says, you know, Lois and I read it aloud. In fact, that's one of the ways that they communicated best was they read aloud to each other. And he said, I'm passing it on to the gang. Other stuff happens, like this guy, Arthur Ford. If you want to read a really fun book, Nothing So Strange. And it's Arthur Ford's autobiography. He was one of the great mediums of his time. And he and Bill met, and they got involved with this mediumistic stuff. And Bill's walking through New York one day, and he has this overwhelming feeling. And he goes up to Ford's apartment and finds Ford just about dead and was able to get him to the hospital and stuff. And Ford was always really grateful after that to be it. And so he was particularly helpful to Bill and Lois and a lot of the people at the AA office. So he and Bill have gotten together, and he says, Bill, I got a message to you from Reverend Tunks. Bill says, really? Why didn't Tunks just call me? He said, he's been dead for a few months now, Bill. Bill says, nah, I just saw him, you know, at Founders Day a few weeks ago. He says, oh, he's dead. And here's the information that he wants you to know. And son of a gun, if it wasn't something that made sense that nobody else could have known. This is a little thing about the Houdini affair, and Arthur Ford was involved in that. If you want to go down that particular wormhole, it's a lot of fun. But please read first the book, Nothing So Strange, because in it, Ford also talks about
having this psychic gift and then getting in a car accident and becoming strung out on morphine. And the doctors want to get him off morphine, so they wean him off with alcohol, and he becomes a hopeless alcoholic. And but there's a really elegant about 4 pages in there where he's talking about being 12-step and about going through the steps. Now, Bill is always talking about trying to get away from Alcoholics Anonymous. Not get away, not flee, but allowing Alcoholics Anonymous to cover itself, to be free to make its own decisions. And this is a letter that Bill sent to Frank Amos. Frank Amos was the guy that Mr. Rockefeller sent out to Akron to check out whether or not Bob and the boys were actually staying sober. And Amos is down in Florida, and he writes Bill a letter in 1960 saying, Dr. Bob's showing up at these church meetings that I'm at. What do you think about that? And Bill writes him back, and he says, when this year is finished with all its special events, 1960, the convention in Long Beach, Lois and I hope to take a deeper interest in the psychic world. Bill believed that if he could help prove that this stuff scientifically, they could capture the spirit infrared, that it would help mankind in a way that Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't, that there were bigger things for him to do. Now and then we go to Stanford with Ann and DeVoe, B, co-founder of Al-Anon. Dr. Bob turns up there now and again. A very different world. A very different world. So this is next section's a little bit about what I like to call medicine's promise. Again, we're talking about the 1940s, the 1950s. Maybe some of you know that. How many folks saw the documentary that just came out a little while ago? It's wonderful. It's a wonderful piece of work. It was actually done by 2 members of the Al-Anon Fellowship. So I think they were able to tell the truth in maybe ways that other people couldn't. There was a lot in there about Bill's depression. So just to let you know, here in Southern California, in a lot of areas, there's a relationship that a lot of us have had. You know, some of us were fortunate enough to know him when he was alive, with Chuck C., who led a retreat that became the book, The New Pair of Glasses. He and Bill had a lot of contact. And he's talking to, he sent a letter to Bill. This is an excerpt from it. Bill had shared his difficulties, and Chuck says, I'm sorry. So you've got these problems. What about it's not I, Bill, but the Father within me that doeth the works? Of myself I am nothing. My health, my strength, my wisdom, and my substance. My very life are the gift of God, in whom we live and move and have our being. I know that you know all these things, but the trick is in acting as if they were true and proving them true. It's the truth that sets us free. No more paper, no more talk. Elsa joins in sending love to you all. So Bill's unburdened himself, and this guy's saying, you're just not, you gotta apply yourself more. This is Bill's response. Dear Chuck, thanks a lot for the thoughtful note. In the last line of your letter, you say, I know that you know all these things, but the trick is acting as if they're true. Well, Chuck, that's exactly the point. To make the job work, there must be conviction and willingness and the will to act as if they were true. Some of us seem to lack the conviction or else the capability of doing so. If everyone could or would act like this, it is certain that we would all be far better off. He says, I have a friend down south who's just written a book. He's supremely happy in a conviction. He believes that he's made a new religious insight. And what the religious insight is that you breathe out ego and breathe in God. That's it. Bill said, I asked him, what do you do when your nose gets stopped up? The guy said, breathe in God. And Bill says, well, it works for the guy, so what are you going to do? But later on, he says, uh, Those evenings we spent together will long be remembered, but if I have a bellyache next time, I shall surely try to keep it to myself. That sure would be a net gain. Lois and I join in sending you the very best. So here Bill is, thinking that he's talking to somebody that he might be able to confide in. The guy gives him some good information. But, and again, Bill just goes, oh, okay, you don't understand. All right, cool. I won't bring it up again. This depression that Bill had, and I've lived with a depressive. I've taken a lot of depressives. But when it really comes to true depression, I don't know what I'm talking about. I really don't know what I'm talking about at all. And I can pretend. Bill's talking to a guy, and Bill got, I mean, can you, has anybody ever said, well, I'm working with too many people? Well, we can't say that this weekend, but anyway. But the pressure of it all is too much. Can you imagine being the point of contact for every member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Bill got hundreds of letters every day, every week, from people who were in all different levels of experience, but mostly of people that were having problems. And in this letter, Bill says that you may recall that from 1942 until 1955, I was never completely free from depression. In some years, this disability was of suicidal proportions. It's just nice to take a moment and realize the energy and the sacrifice that this man made for us. He's trying different things. He's at a psychic conference, and he meets two guys that are very, very important, I believe, in Bill's surviving and the expansion of consciousness in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two Canadians, Dr. Albert Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond, and did you know them, Mildred? Were they? Was it Humphrey that did that, or Hoffer? Okay. Just say, I got a really good friend here, Mildred Frank, who's going to be talking on the 11th step. She has meant more to me than most of the members of Alcoholics. I have had a very deep and abiding love for her. So let's just for a moment take a moment and think about what this guy, for those of us who've had the chance of experiencing Mildred, gave to us in bringing her out of the net ward, where she may have belonged anyway, but into Alcoholics Anonymous. And anyway, they came up with a natural substance called leukoandrenochrome that was a very effective anti-anxiety compound, these two doctors. And for very tense individuals, that produces a pretty immediate effort. Now, Bill was real familiar with sedatives and tranquilizers and all this stuff, and he knew that shouldn't be touched. But he's sitting there with two medical doctors, and he's all tense and weird. And Osmond said, here, try this. Bill tries it, and he can't believe what happens. And they spent a number of years where Bill did everything he could to try and get this thing tested and popularized, and Bill himself was a lab rat for this stuff while they're trying to make it work. The reason we never hear about it is that they were never able to get it shelf-stable. But Bill was convinced that it had a profound effect on his ability to relax, that it was not an outside substance, it was a natural thing that was produced, and he was very, very enthusiastic about it. Just to give you an idea about the things that he was doing to try and help alcoholics, because he would not. Bill, time and time again, he goes and tries stuff, and people have opinions about what it is that he's doing. They don't have experience. And he gets criticized and yelled at all the time. So he's doing this test, trying this leuco out, and he's keeping a diary for the doctor about what's going on. And just family problems, serious illness of friends, writing under forced draft, controversial meetings at the office, increased number of deadlines that must be met in the next 30 days. This all adds up to a lot of pressure. On the 11th day, I was forced to bed for the day. Took a couple of Leucos. The combination of anxiety, frustration, and exhaustion completely stopped me. Tried writing in bed, but had to quit. By mid-afternoon, felt almost hysterical. Could not eat. Took the material again. Things eased. The next day, rose jittery, rebellious at the demands of many people for attention. Still another problem case coming to the house this evening. Looking toward the future commitments makes me want to run up to the country indefinitely. Knowing that I can't gives me the rather and familiar sensation of being trapped for the rest of my life. And he was with this all the time. And then the next line is, not much real depression, however. I don't know what I don't know. People send Bill letters all the time. He got this letter from Betty, who wasn't able to get together with our friend Steve last night. Her husband was strung out on Dexamil. And Bill's saying, I'm not too familiar with Dexamil. He says, this is pretty natural, of course, for us people to take, but as addicts, we simply can't use these new drugs, stimulants, tranquilizers, and sedatives. They become addictions in themselves, even far worse than alcohol in many cases. Now, again, I'm not saying anything about the signalness of purpose. I'm an AA, I hope you can tell, I'm an AA guy. But I just want to say, and again, this is private. This is not a public pronouncement. But there it is, as addicts. And Bill wasn't just locked into helping drunks. He wanted to be helpful to more and more people. There's this guy, Carol Chessman, who was the red light bandit. Think of the worst guy you can think of. This guy would, just for fun, he would take young prostitutes, rape, kill them, and steal their money. Just that, so you can imagine, really bad guy. Got it? They get him, they put him on trial, they put him on death row. While he's there, he has an experience. It's not a religious conversion experience. But he sees that his problems are of his own making. This insight that he has that he never had before, because he had always been run on his own instincts, he starts trying to be helpful to other people who may be unconscious of the way they're acting. Jack Alexander, the guy who wrote the Saturday Evening Post article that actually is the reason why we're all here today, goes and interviews Chessman, and they become friendly. He says to Chessman, you know, you might be able to really help, because Chessman's thinking, if other criminals might know what it is that's going on, maybe there's some way that we might be... Jack says, write Bill Wilson. And so he does. And they're talking about, you know, well, should I set up a rather unholy meeting for these people? But how is it that I can take this insight that I've had and put it towards fellow sufferers? And Bill sends this letter to Chessman in response to, he says, being much better behaved on the surface, society does not take the fact that it has become just as sick as we are. It can't think of itself as destructively neurotic, nor can it see the merely grotesque and dangerous end product of its own defects. People of all kinds and of every class, collectively and individually, are hipped on the pursuit of money, prestige, and power as never before. The demands for these things has utter, and it's terrifying, and it's absolute. To fail to get them is to be unhappy, overwhelmed with rebellion, and crave revenge and suffer depression. My friend Bill Cleveland's parents, our friend Cliff that's talking, Mildred, A lot of the senior members here remember when it was that alcoholics were jailed. That was society's solution. And again, in the postmodern era, we don't have any, we think of it as a disease and this and that, and not the social problem that a lot of these folks said it was. Bill says, I think that society is only beginning to catch on to the fact that its own neurosis is tearing it apart. It still looks on people like you and me as dangerous or wicked freaks who ought to be punished or maybe killed off. So he saw no difference from the desperation of the problem of alcoholism with this guy. Because, you know, the big 12th step hadn't happened where alcoholism was acknowledged as a disease. One of the books that Bill does recommend is this book called Heaven and Hell by Aldous Huxley. And it's about the nature of expanded consciousness and intuition. Aldous Huxley is a marvelous, marvelous author. You may have read the a lot of us had to read Brave New World when we were in school back in one of those days. It's about expanded consciousness. And a lot of folks, when they're talking about Bill and Lois enjoying this book, and Bill actually, in a letter to Gerald Hurd, says, please tell Aldous that Lois and I believe that it mirrors our experience and that we agree with every word of heaven and hell. And when you read it, it's about mescaline. Okay? Bill had not had his experience with psychedelics yet. And yet he's talking about his own psychic experiences and his exploration. So when he's talking about agreeing with this, it's prior to him having those experiences. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about LSD. When I talk about LSD, you have no idea what it is that I'm saying. I'm talking about a medicine. I'm talking about psychic research to help a variety of mental problems. I'm talking about courageous women and men doing what they can to attempt to be helpful. I'm not talking about people that are using it with a half gallon of Spinata just to... Don't you love these ceilings? Do they speak to you? Anyway. But Bill, in writing a confidential letter to the Reverend Sam Shoemaker, his spiritual advisor, says, before taking LSD, the very thought that three pills might produce an experience was revolting. He doesn't want to take it. He thinks it's a cheap trick. It's a shortcut. But there's something going on. He's got these two friends, Hoffman and Osmond, who are dealing with people that have very, very difficult experiences with alcoholism and unable to recover. And again, Bill's talking to him, and he says, when people hear that I'm interested in this stuff, what's going to happen is, it's, again, contempt prior to investigation. That will be the rule. They won't investigate. They'll only yell. All this stuff that I'm going to be speaking about for the next few minutes is medically supervised. It isn't going into the closet with Willie and seeing where you end up. Okay? So Bill goes out to UCLA because he doesn't want to go to Canada to have this done. And he, under the care of a Dr. Sidney Cohen and Keith Dittman, he takes LSD not to expand his consciousness, not to get high, but because he's been led to believe by men that he trusts that are medical doctors that there is something in this that can be of help to alcoholics. And that's why he has the experience. What happens is that he felt that his original experience the one that we're celebrating in Towns Hospital, was confirmed. That, not that there was something, not that there was hallucinations going on. Again, this is the people that have experience with this medicine uniformly report almost exactly the same experiences. Much, much different than anything that you and I might have run across over the years. So he comes back, and what does he do? He does exactly what they did in Bedford Hills. But instead of a spook group, this is the LSD group. Always supervised. Dr. Robert Laidlaw's there, and there was also another doctor. Another participant was this guy, Eugene Exman, who was the religion editor at Harper's. Then there's Tom P., Zippar, some people from the office, Helen W., Lib S., Nell Wing was involved. Lois got to do a little LSD also with under Dr. Osmond's care. But, again, they didn't give her much of a dose, much to Bill's. And so she didn't really have much of an experience, or maybe she just lived more that way than you or I. Now, so again, this is all a medically supervised protocol. This has nothing to do with getting loaded. And when they talk about the LSD tests, if you know, because there's lots of stuff that folks say, and one of the reasons that I really wanted, especially for this group, because one of the things that, thank you, Bob, that we've done is here is that we've got this wonderful template of consciousness that is of very active members, is to say, look, if people are talking about this, it's not that Bill was being weird. It was that he was trying to help drunks. And there's a real difference. He talks about Dittman and Cohn looking at him when he's describing his experience, and he says, they looked at me like a butterfly stuck on a pin. I was just a case. But last summer, Dittman and Cohen came to our house at Bedford Hills. If ever I saw a changed man, it was the same Dittman. He'd taken the material two or three times. He had an experience. And he could not deny the objective reality of what he'd seen, though he'd made every effort to dislodge this notion. So what does Bill do? He does what was done for him. He said, I got out William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, and I read them certain passages. When they heard the mystic experiences read from James and thought of the over 400 people to whom they had given the drug, they were able to say that many of the experiences of the book were reproduced in their patients. Not what you, again, when I speak about this material, it's not what it is that you think it is. It's coming from doctors there's a book, A New Hope for Alcoholics. And in it, it describes what it is the work that Osmond and Hoffer did. In one of the letters that Bill sends to Carl Jung, there were two, he talks about that he thinks that this is a real gateway. That this is a place that people that are trapped can get free. He says 150 cases have been treated by my Canadian friends. As of this writing, 75 are remaining perfectly sober in the outside world. And these people that he's talking about are street drunks. Earlier in these are people that have been to AA. They're indigents. They're living on the streets in Saskatchewan. You think it's bad here? It's right between what? Incomprehensible and demoralized, right? Sister Mary Eugenia might speak tomorrow about that. But anyway, but these people, which Bill said 5%, AA's having a 5% success rate with these folks. Of the 150 that are being treated by these guys, half of them are sober and staying that way. And they're not taking the material again. Bill keeps saying, you know, you don't need to replicate the experience once you've had the kiss. once you've had the kiss. So this is the last section for those of you who are, and it's the personal philosophy. Bill talking about why he wrote the 12 and 12. He said, I wrote the second book because people were treating the first as if it was holy writ. Later on, he says, how can I get them to stop? He knew who wrote it. You know, God and a bunch of his friends, you know, a few of his buddies were really the people that wrote the book. Bill says, we already know, he's talking about why Alcoholics Anonymous is not a Christian movement. He says, we already know as a fact that some theological propositions are tremendous tremendous obstacles to place in the way of atheist and agnostic drunks. Therefore, the only theological proposition in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is God, a higher power, and God as we understand him. I also had in mind that there were a great many drunks in other religions. This is indeed turning out to be the case. Alcoholism is not confined to Christianity. We've made a promising beginning in the Buddhist world. Supposing this movement carried the Christian label, it is relevant to ask oneself how far we could go in such cases. Bill says in his I'm deeply ashamed to say that I've never read the Old Testament to any extent at all. Respecting the New, I'm only a little less ignorant. When it comes to the sense and nonsense of Christianity, I'm the merest novice. But I do feel that the world needs a restatement of theology, at least one that convincingly explains who man is, what this sojourn is all about, and where he goes next, and what his ultimate destiny may be. When I have the times, I'd really like to spend more time with this. Since AA came of age and I retired, but I've never had so many distractions since the old AA juggernaut first started to roll. This is a book called The Imprisoned Splendor by Raynor Johnson. The second half of it is very elegant. And this is the only book that I know that Bill recommended to people that were suffering. Raynor is R-A-Y-N-O-R, for those that have got the tape. Raynor Johnson. The book is The Imprisoned Splendor. And he was talking to this guy about, you know, I wish I could spend a couple days with you sharing all the different stuff that I've seen, but the truth is, I can't, so I'm sending you this book. He said, this mirrors my what I believe better than anything, and this was in 1958. Now, here's the Akron pamphlets, and I think that it's really important to really step back for a second when we're talking about the book, Alcoholics Anonymous and its importance and all that stuff. 1940. The book's been out for a couple of months. Bob turns around to his friends and says, look, this book's all wonderful and everything. They also didn't participate much in writing it, so you can always cap on the pitch after it's been made, right? He says, we need something that's going to be for the working guy. So they came up with a series of pamphlets that wouldn't cost as much when they were sending them out to people. And these have been published since 1940. And you can get them from the Akron Central Office. And it says, this historical literature was written by Evan W. at the request of Dr. Bob. He felt that the newly written big book was too difficult for the blue-collar worker to read. Evan was a former writer for the newspaper and wrote a manual for Alcoholics Anonymous in 1941 and a second reader for Alcoholics Anonymous. In this pamphlet from 1940, there's a pamphlet called Spiritual Milestones in AA. It's a fantastic thing if you like Christian literature. And I read it a bunch and enjoyed it. But near the close, there's some very interesting stuff that happens. And this comes from Bob. This comes from the old-timers in Akron. It says, consider the 8-part program laid down by Buddhism. Right view, right aim, right speech, right living, right action, right effort, right-mindedness, and right contemplation. Then it says, the Buddhist philosophy, as exemplified by these 8 points, could be literally adopted by AA as a substitute for or an addition to the 12 steps. Akron? Bob? Come on. And he wasn't putting a hole in the boat. Now, I'm not, but what I'd like you to do is just, I mean, I know what I'd say if somebody in my home group said that 15 years ago. But that's straight AA. Bill says that I trust that AA is going to be intelligent enough and spiritualized enough to get accurate guidance from God and to do what it should, on what it should do and how it should behave. Bill was in contact with Roland Jones, or Roland J., from Akron all the way till the end of his life. He said in a letter to him, I think it would be unwise to try, period. At this stage, dependence should be on God and not upon AA elders. And finally, this is my favorite picture of Bob. Looks like he's doing a conga line with the nurses. This is from when he's an intern. He's got that old globe on him. Well, it's a lot of fun trying to figure it out if you don't take yourself too seriously. And all that I've been trying to do is give you the opportunity to maybe not take yourself too seriously. Carl Jung, in talking about Roland's experience, said that the solution to alcoholism is spiritus contra spiritum, the spirit of God against the spirits of alcohol. Thank you very much. If anybody's got any desire, and please, you don't feel that you need to at all, to ask any questions, I'll be happy in my limited fashion to respond to any questions you might have. Cool. Yes, sir.
I'm Bill, alcoholic. Talk a little bit about the letters that Bill wrote to Dowling, which we don't have in our archives, but are in the Jesuit Order archives. There was a book published.
Yeah. The question is, would you talk about Bill's correspondence with Ed Dowling? There's a book called The Soul of Sponsorship that's available from Hazelden, and it's a great book and really good stuff. And the reason that I don't talk about Bill and Ed much is that that's all there, and it's out. But one of the things that I didn't mention is that Bill said that it was fascinating that Dowling never tried to convert him to Catholicism, and he said that he always deeply appreciated that. He shared a transcript with Dowling of one of his experiences on LSD, and asked Dowling what he thought about it, and he said, your spiritual insights are childish and specious, and this should be stopped now.
Yes.
Very good. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
hi, how are you doing?